So, welcome to the Toncast. I'm Ira Goldstein, and my very special guest is Todd Robert Anderson, who I saw in a television commercial when I was watching a football game this Sunday.
Oh, no kidding.
Yes.
Kentucky Fried
Kentucky,
Chicken.
Kentucky Fried, the Little Something or Others.
Yeah, it's the, yeah, the little, they have the new Chicken Little sandwiches or whatever they're called.
Yeah. So, what was your motivation in that?
My motivation was to get a check. But in addition to getting a check, that's the main reason I do commercials is okay. to get checks. But in addition to that, it was directed by a guy named David O. Russell.
Really?
Who, yes.
The real David O. Russell?
The real, honest to goodness, David O. Russell, who directed Three Kings
and all that, yeah.
And Spanky and the Monkey yeah. and a lot of movies that I really like. So I was hesitant to do it because initially, now everybody's seen it, so good news, it's a national spot, but when I shot it, it was a test spot. And usually test spots are, you know, the idea is they're testing a new product or they're testing a new type of ad campaign in a very small market.
I was going to say, it's in a local market somewhere.
Yes. And if it does well, then it'll roll out nationally. That's what they say. But that's you know, getting fish on the hook as far as performers are concerned, because I've done a number of test spots. I've never seen one roll out nationally. This is the first time.
First time.
Very first time. A lot of times that test spots come up around the holidays, which I believe is in general when it's the end of, you know, their fiscal season at any given corporation. So the corporation's marketing department has to reach a certain quota as far as money spent.
Aha.
And it, actually, if they come under it the next time, that's what they get. So if they don't spend all their money, they get less money. So around the holidays, there's various commercials that are, you know, who knows if they're going to air.
And that was a national commercial. It wasn't like part of the local broadcast for the game? Just out of curiosity.
The KFC?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a national spot now. I mean, it's airing everywhere. So it was, if you saw it on a game, it was the network. Yeah. You know, it wasn't a local spot. I mean, but it doesn't really matter if it's a local spot, because it's all broken up according to regions across the country. Where you get residuals from, residual checks, that money.
The money.
The magical money.
Yes.
It's all broken up in regions. So if it's a regional spot, okay, a local market, that's where you get paid for that. And the reason why a national matters is a national commercial airs in all of the different markets. So then you get
a bunch of different regions.
Yes, exactly.
Huh, very interesting.
Yeah, you get paid by region in 13-week cycles. That's why when people say to me, wow, I saw that commercial like 8 times last night. You must be making so much money. And I say, no, if you had only seen it once, I would make the same amount of money.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because it's blocks of time. There is such a thing as a wild spot, which is a pay-per-play kind of situation, but it doesn't come up very often.
So I saw that in between driving around this weekend, back and forth over the same stretch of the 405, and I was thinking that would be a good thing on my tombstone. Like, drove the same stretch of the 405 18 times one day and didn't complain about it.
So you're not a complainer.
No, I'm not a complainer. But and then I was thinking, what would you want on your tombstone? Ever thought about that?
You know, it's really funny that you say that, because a lot of times I post things on Twitter. Are you on the Twitter?
I'm not on Twitter.
But I'm on the Twitter, and every now and then I have those thoughts, like what would be a funny thing to put on my tombstone. And so I tweet that. So there's a series of tweets. If you go on Twitter and you follow me, you can see a bunch of my tweets about that very thing.
Tombstone tweets.
Tombstone tweets, yeah.
Not the movie, but the
Yeah. my tombstone will probably read blah, blah, blah. But I think the first thing that I ever wanted, I don't know why I thought this, like a long time ago when I was a kid. I guess I was a cynic even as a kid. But it was, here lies, the tombstone says, here lies Todd Robert Anderson. He was generally unimpressed.
And as a kid, you were thinking that.
That's as a kid. I was like, that'd be funny to put on my tombstone.
Yeah.
But it's just as a joke. I'm impressed by a lot of things. But that would be a funny thing to put on your tombstone.
Is like any movies lately that have impressed you? Because I was like, I heard the box office returns from this last week, and I don't think one movie made even $10 million. And I think
no, they all did poorly. Yeah. And then was it Oogie Loves that opened this last week, or was that the week before?
I don't even know.
I can't remember, but Oogie Loves is the kid movie with the fever dream puppet people.
Oh, no, I haven't seen that. I haven't heard of
it. It's a G-rated movie. It's aimed for 3 to 5-year-olds. And the concept was it was interactive, so it would get your like little kids up jumping around. Now, I saw the trailer for this before I saw Paranorman a few weeks ago.
You have a young kid.
Have a young kid. But, you know, the truth is, if I didn't, I still would have seen Paranorman because I like animated movies. But I don't know how to describe it. It was a fever dream.
The movie.
Of a trailer. Oogie Loves. It was just a trailer before the movie. And it was like, I've had that the same sort of emotional experience twice within a few days of each other. First, it was seeing Clint Eastwood talk to an empty chair. And then it was seeing the trailer for Oogie Loves.
And that both elicited the same feeling.
Like a very similar feeling. Like, is this, you know that, like,
yeah.
I actually went into denial about both of those things when I was like, this can't be happening right now. This isn't a real thing. I'm having a fever dream. This is a fever dream. Yeah. And then once I realize it's real, then there's like a kind of crushing moment where I become sad. And then I start laughing about it.
You become sad.
Well,
because
with Oogie Loves, I'm a huge fan of kids movies, and one of the things that bugs me these days is there aren't enough kids movies outside of the animated realm. So this is a live action movie.
Oh, is it?
I mean, it's very, you know, CG heavy, but it's people in suits. It's like Teletubbies, and it's actually, I think the guy who made this was like worked on Teletubbies or whatever, but it's people in suits talking to actual actors like Christopher Lloyd and Cloris Leachman. Like a bunch of people I actually like.
Who are still alive, even.
Who are still kicking and are fun. And in watching the trailer, I had that whole experience. It's like the grief experience. At first, it was denial, then it was tears, and then ultimately, you know, led to laughter, which is a great healer.
Yes.
And I had the same experience watching Eastwood talk to an empty chair.
Like you kept checking to see if your TV was really on.
Because I had not.
Like aliens are broadcasting this. And
for whatever reason, I don't watch the RNC or the DNC. I don't like pep rallies. I'm not a fan of it. So, and that's all these things are in my mind.
There's a lot of crap to wade through.
Well, it's just like, to get to what? To get to a speech where somebody says nothing. Yeah. They're pep rallies. Yeah. That's all they are. I don't know why we put so much weight on them, but we do. It's like the Oscars. Okay. I don't understand why we put so much weight on the importance of what is, you know, a circle jerk.
I would say both were different back in the day. Back in the day, the conventions actually nominated somebody.
That's true.
Back in the day, the Oscars went to movies that were popular as well as...
That's true.
Something else.
Well, and the Oscars before they were televised would happen in a Hollywood living room when Hollywood was a much smaller thing. And nobody was making the kind of money they make now. Well, I agree. That's a solid point. It's tradition. I would say that both of those things as they exist now are pointless.
Yeah.
And they're a waste of money, especially the RNC and the DNC. I mean, the Oscars is a waste of money, but it's capitalist, you know. They're making money back. They have commercials, you know. It creates jobs. You know, all that. And I just, with the DNC and the RNC, all the jobs that the people have who organize it, you know, save for the TV crews that would be covering something else anyway if it wasn't happening, are there. So it's just the whole thing strikes me as a giant waste of money.
It's not like William F. Buckley calling, or Gore Vidal calling William F. Buckley a crypto-Nazi.
Yeah,
Back in the day, you don't have that kind of thing anymore.
No, you don't. People pull punches, but beyond that, it's just, I don't know.
But then preaching
to the choir. That's what it is.
Yeah,
but then Eastwood
talking to an empty chair.
But that's why, because I watched talking so little of it, and then when I saw that, like, I'm like, that's. I turned on the TV. I was just waiting for my wife to come out so we could put on a movie or something, and I was just watching TV, and that was on. I was like, oh, Eastwood's up. Well, we'll see what he has to say. And then he starts, I got Obama here. That's the first thing he said, where I was like, eh? Is he doing a bit? You know, is Eastwood doing a bit without an orangutan? Because that's a mistake.
Yeah. He was without a script or anything.
He was doing. And it was he can't improvise to save his life.
And supposedly the chair part was he said to somebody, "Bring me a chair."
Bring me a chair. They had no idea. They didn't okay what he was going to say at all. They were like, "Well, it's Eastwood. It's going to be awesome."
Yeah.
And according to the anchors on Fox News, it was. They all thought it was brilliant, which is unbelievable. But I mean, just the fact that he started talking to an invisible Obama on a chair. That's when I stopped and went, okay, he's just doing a bit. All right, this is odd. And he was so berating to the invisible president that I was like, wow, this is intensely disrespectful. But that's okay, you know, freedom of speech, all that. I'm like, but if I was, a Republican, I would be like, oh, please get him off stage as quickly as possible. This is going south.
Yeah,
I can see it going south. And that's why I was in that state of denial. Like, I can't. This is like a Daily Show bit, and I'm on the wrong channel. I couldn't believe it.
Or the Democrats have somehow got into the feed.
I love the conspiracy theories that secretly he's a Democrat, and he was. but then, like, his improv too, there was a number of moments where he would talk to the chair, like, and have a conversation with the chair that he would not allow the audience into. Like, if you're having a conversation with an invisible person and you're doing comedy improv, you have to, like, say in your dialogue explicitly,
like Bob Newhart talking on a telephone, like, he lets everyone know what's going
explicitly
on.
Explicitly,
he does
you
both
let them
sides
know.
Of the conversation,
right? Exactly, but Eastwood was just at times just like, what? Oh, no, that's right. Shut up. You know, I was like, what is he doing? I mean, it's a magical moment in U.S. history.
And then it's the same as the kids movie there. In
well, the same experience watching the trailer of Oogie Loves, because the same thing happened to me. I was like, is this really happening? Am I actually seeing this, or am I tripping out? That's what it was. And that movie is the lowest has the lowest box office returns in history, apparently, for a wide release.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's not the biggest financial bomb of all time, which I think currently is Zizek's Road with Tom Sizemore, but that movie only opened in one theater. And only played for a few days there. And only six people saw it in the theater. But that's a different scenario.
But there must be some that went straight to video or DVD or something like that.
Yeah, but that doesn't count. It's like, I'm talking about wide-release films. Oogie Loves was on 2,000 screens and made
$2,000.
Unbelievably low number. Yeah, so it's the biggest box office bomb.
And you didn't go see it either. You contributed to that, though.
No, I even asked my son if he would want to go see it. And he's just about to turn 7, but he said, no, that movie's for babies. And this is a kid who will see anything.
Tight audience there, yeah.
But yeah, but it made me sad because, you know, I wish there were more fun live-action movies for kids.
Yeah.
That were good.
Well, like, I was trying to think of, like, Babe. back in the day.
Babe's a good movie. Yeah. I mean, but even like less sappy, like an adventure film, like the original Star Wars trilogy, those are all PG-rated movies. Those are all K for 5-6-year-olds. So I just, that doesn't happen.
Or even the live action stuff that Disney used to do back in the 50s and 60s.
Oh, yeah.
Like Treasure Island, things like that.
Treasure Island Journey to the Center of the Earth and 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Journey to the Center of the Earth, my favorite movie ever when I was a kid. The it's James Mason version with Arlene Dahl.
It's a great
Pat movie. Boone without his shirt on.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's awesome. It's a little slow. I mean, it doesn't hold up.
It doesn't? Really?
Well, it's still fun, but it doesn't have the pacing for, you know, it's paced kind of slowly.
Yeah. Oh, for, yeah, that well, I guess modern audiences, even The Godfather's pace too slow for young people today.
Well, I don't know about that. That's actually...
At least that's what I read somewhere. That
The Godfather's too slow?
The Godfather's too slow. They can't even fathom watching a black and white movie. Like, this would be a college film criticism class that had to watch The Godfather and found it too slow. To deal with, yeah.
That's... Because when I watched The Godfather, and I didn't see The Godfather until I was in college, and I was pretty resistant to seeing it because it was 3 hours. And it looked really boring to me. But I... Both Godfather and Godfather 2, I was mesmerized by. But it's different. I mean, I think... like that subject matter and the characters and everything in that those first two movies are very volatile, and it smolders, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's a drama, but to me there's not a wasted moment in those movies. I think if you're bored by The Godfather, you should probably sit down and start doing some reading and educating yourself, and maybe, you know, you're there's too much Facebook and Twitter in your life, but it's a little different with the old Disney movies, which are actually just kind of slow.
Yeah. Well, I think, I have no idea. The Robert Newton Treasure Island that I saw when I was a kid, I wonder how that would hold up now.
Is that the Disney one?
Yeah, that's with Bobby Driscoll as a kid.
Yeah, that's a fun movie, actually. I mean, it's both that. Journey's a slower paced movie, and 20,000 Leagues is a slower paced movie than.
That I can't remember. That much, but
Treasure Island is better because it's got pirates and stuff, and you know, there's less sitting around. I mean, like Journey has a lot of sitting around and talking about scientific theory in it.
Yeah, until they get to inside the actual journey with Arnie Sacknesson and all that.
Yeah,
they're following
Arnie
Sacknesson through the whole thing.
It's fun.
I remember that way too well for having seen it way too long ago when it first came out.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. But, for me, they hold up in that. They're fun adventure movies, and you can show them to a little.
But there's really nothing like that anymore for kids.
No. I mean, and there was the Journey to the Center of the Earth, the IMAX movie, and then the Journey 2, which are okay. I mean, they're super cheesy.
With, what's his name?
The first one's with Brendan Fraser, and the second one's with The Rock. Dwayne Johnson's... I love The Rock, all right? I'm not saying that because I'm about to say something negative about The Rock, but I actually really love The Rock. I think he's a lot of fun. But in that movie, he's wearing these really tight t-shirts, and I don't know what, like, they probably filmed it on a stage, you know, so it was probably like really super cold.
You mean they didn't go to the center of the earth?
They didn't go to the, Well, it's like one of those movies. Well, sometimes, you know, when they have like a jungle movie, they'll go shoot in Hawaii or whatever. Maybe they shot some of it.
Or the
Arboretum. But a lot of it looked like a soundstage, you know. But he had these tight shirts on, and his nipples were like in the, like, placed so strangely. Like when you see it on a giant screen, it's in 3D. It's impossible not to notice.
They're like poking you in the eye.
I mean, because his pectorals are they're situated so prominently throughout the film. I mean, they want you to. That's what they're giving to the grown-ups.
Yeah.
You know, the kids get the adventure, and the grown-ups get the Rock's pecs. You know, it's hot or something, but it his nipples are, and I don't know if it's because of the way he works out or whatever, but his nipples are like way too low on. I mean, he's giant pecs, but his nipples are like basically
pointing
downward.
Huh.
And at first, you know, I said to Hill, is that like a lapel mic that fell down his shirt? But then when he turned around, there was two matching ones. I was like, are those his nipples? That's so weird. How does he get them like that? It freaked me out, man.
A lot of bench pressing that... I think, actually, I remember that in a movie that I saw too many... Mean Streets. Harvey Keitel has... There's a scene where he's topless and his breasts were hanging down. I thought, that's weird. It was a guy.
He has hanging boobs.
Yeah.
But he had man boobs.
They were man boobs.
Was he in super good shape?
He was in sort of good shape. I mean, it's 40 years ago, so he was way younger.
Right. But it's not like The Rock where he was bodybuilding.
Not like that at all.
To that degree.
When I see stuff like that, so I always think to myself, like, am I really here or not here?
That's why it's like an out of body experience. It's like, did I just trip into a parallel universe?
Did I just like change over to another path in my life here?
Yeah.
I'm still here, but now I'm in a different path.
But now I'm in a different universe. Yeah. And everything's slightly different after this moment.
Yeah.
That's what both Clint Eastwood and the Oogie Loves have done to me.
It's like what Philip K. Dick was obsessed with, authentic fakes.
Yes, the Uncanny Valley and all that stuff.
Yeah, it's like, how can you tell if it's real or not? If it's a perfect replica, then it might be real. And then if it's real, then maybe you're in a slightly, ever so slightly changed version of the future.
Because like if you take something like cloning and you take your duplicity with Michael Keaton, or multiplicity rather, with Michael Keaton, it was clear that the copies were off. They looked like him, but they were off. There was the dumb one and the really alpha one and all that stuff. But if it was a perfect Michael Keaton, how would you know which one is the real Michael Keaton?
Yeah, it would start and it would go on a totally different path and change that whole
It would have been line. Probably a more interesting movie that way.
Although there was a book I read once, David Gerald's book. It was called The Man Who Folded Himself. And he repeatedly goes into the past and leaves his person in the past, I think. And then they go off on a different line so that he has all these multiple lines and meets himself every once in a while that are on totally different paths, but they still intersect.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
I didn't read that book, but I saw this movie called The Mangler, which is, it's based on a Stephen King short story. It's directed by Toby Hooper, and it stars Robert Englund and, I'm forgetting his name, the guy who played Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs, Ted Levine.
Uh-huh.
Ted Levine's in it. He's the hero.
of course.
And Robert Englund's the evil guy who runs the laundry factory, and it's about like a haunted laundry machine. Every now and then it eats somebody.
Who's just there to do their laundry.
Like one of the workers. It's a laundry factory where they like do sheets and stuff. I don't know. It's like, I don't know. I can't really explain the film.
And Toby Hooper.
But what happens at a certain point in the climax is Robert Englund gets folded up in the laundry machine because you feed the sheets into it and it washes the sheets and then it folds them perfectly in this giant mechanical machine, but he falls into it and then the machine folds him up into a bunch of pieces. But that's totally different. But at the same time, it's also about a man getting folded up.
Yes,
that's all I'm saying.
But then Toby Hooper, it's like, whatever happened to him? I mean, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, I remember seeing that's another one of those authentic fake things for me. When I saw that, I couldn't tell. I didn't really think that they were acting. I thought he like stumbled, like it was like the pseudo-documentary of this weird-ass family that were...
Well, that's what's like weird about the movie that's sort of effective in a way is that the first half of it, I mean, the family doesn't come to play till the second half, like midway through the second act. And it just starts off as this kind of like terrible slasher film with horrible act. I mean, the acting is terrible. The kids are terrible. You got that annoying fat guy in the wheelchair. I mean, I never hated someone so much in a movie that was in it. Usually they're very sweet. You know, I'll give him that choice. He made like a really annoying wheelchair guy.
But you're very happy to see him.
Oh, yeah. You want to see him dispatched. But when that first moment of like, whoa, all bets are off is when Leatherface just like clubs the guy with the meat tenderizer.
Yeah.
Or I think it's a meat tenderizer.
Yeah,
or something you would kill an animal with or whatever. But he like just hits him and then he drags him really fast into like the back room and then slams that sliding metal meat locker door. And that, like, from that moment onward, it's all the acting from the crazy people is so utterly disturbingly convincing that you wonder, did Tobe Hooper take these poor half-wit amateurish actors and actually kill all of them? I don't know. It has that feeling.
It did have that feeling for me. I actually saw it in the theater, and
I can't imagine what that was.
Yeah, like. I was at a job that I hated, so it was playing in Hollywood. I just went in the middle of the day to go see it, like me and two other people in the theater. And
it must have been creepy with just a couple of people.
Yeah, it was just scared the crap out of me.
Sounds awful. Because I saw it like on video, you know, on VHS in the 80s.
That's why it's like, I guess that's why it always, I kind of walked out thinking, was that really a movie?
It is, but that's the thing, and that's the whole last half of that movie is mesmerizing, and I think part of the reason it is it's a perfect turn on what the movie seems to be. Oh, this is just a crappy low budget slasher film, and when it first came out, like the slasher genre hadn't taken off yet. Like it was really the Texas Chainsaw Massacre was sort of a stepping stone to Halloween. You know, well, Black Christmas and Halloween, because it came out before. It came out in
74, I want to say.
Early 70s. So it wasn't. So I watched it in retrospective, seeing Slasher, Halloween, and Friday the 13th. I didn't see Texas Chainsaw until after I'd seen those movies. So the first half.
Nightmare on Elm Street, too.
All that shit. And I could go deeper for you if you want. Wishmaster, you know.
You know all that stuff, don't you?
Chrome Skull. All of it. Yeah. Yeah.
So what is it that you like about watching people be eviscerated on the screen?
I started watching movies. I was more of an action junkie, and I sort of discovered the horror genre in tandem, and then my wife is a horror junkie, but I always did like horror movies that were bad. I don't know. I just enjoy I enjoy the inappropriateness of it, and on one hand it makes me sad that some people actually genuinely get off on it.
You mean like these Hostel movies?
I mean, I actually really liked Hostel Part 2. I thought it was a hysterically inappropriate movie. Hostel Part 1's okay, but the torture porn movies, you know, whatever. But whatever it is, a slasher, torture porn, whatever it is, the inappropriateness and irreverence, which the horror genre is a place that those are its things, I find that endlessly amusing.
So it is some kind of send up of society at large.
Well, I think the best horror movies, you know, play as satires or, you know, have an underlying thematic element about society in general. Yeah.
So the movie maker is laughing at the audience? Is that how
I don't know about that. I mean, I think I think the movie maker isn't being condescending. It's just some of the best horror filmmakers are guys who like those things. They like scary stuff, you know, but they're just taking it to the next level, if that makes any sense.
Sort of. But because some of them, I mean, the limited one, I haven't quite seen them the way you have, but they always seem less suspenseful and more like, okay, we need to kill somebody now. It's 10 minutes of gone.
Well, yeah, there's gore porn. I mean, absolutely. And I enjoy that. And again, it's because I just enjoy the inappropriateness of it. And I like bad movies. I like incompetence in filmmaking sometimes. It's enjoyable. I mean, and with gore porn, it's like you're actually getting to the kills, and then it's about the creativity of the kills. You take your Final Destination franchise, which is my favorite example of that, which is just all about... It's not creative about ways. The characters. It's not... Well, the first one more is... I think the first one's actually a pretty effective movie, but the sequels are gore porn. Like, without a doubt. And it's the characters, all they have to be is mildly amusing in between the horrific events that happen to them. But it's all about the creativity of the kills and the gore and how far you're going to take it. Like, how are... And to be a 40-year-old man as I am, and to see something that makes me go, whoa, that's exciting to me. As opposed to, oh, I'm watching another slasher film. Me. But if makes me go, whoa, that's what I'm looking for. Like, holy shit, you actually went there, dude. And it's getting harder and harder and harder to get to that place. From my perspective. Because, you know, I've seen so much.
So it's not erotic anymore. It's more boring then at some point?
No, I still, you know, I can still be amused by it. I have a pretty high threshold for crap when it comes to horror movies. So I'll still be amused by it. But I'm wading through something that I'm either mildly amused by or not amused by at all to get in the hopes that there will be that whoa thing.
I remember watching The Omen way back when.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember. I think it's the scene where the guy's head gets chopped off by the piece of glass. And there's a point in that scene where you think, oh, it's not going to happen.
That's David Warner, yeah.
Yeah, and yes. And that what always impressed me about was the timing of it. So that it times it so that if you wanted to look away, you look away at a certain point, and then you're looking back thinking it's all over, and then it happens. So that they...
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
That was Richard Donner, right?
Yes. Dick Damn. Donner?
Yeah, that's crazy.
Superman and
Lethal Weapon,
yes, all those movies.
Yeah, I love that guy. The Goonies, didn't he do The Goonies?
Did he? I don't know.
He produced it, at least.
Yeah, I think somebody else.
He produced a lot of cool stuff. Was it Dante?
Or is he Gremlins? Goonies, Gremlins?
No, he did Gremlins. Goonies, I swear to God, it was Richard Donner who directed it. It was Spielberg produced it, and Donner directed it. I'm telling you.
Okay. I would look it up, but I really don't want to.
No, it's not important. We'll just let the internet correct us.
Yeah, that's one of those things too. So it would used to be so nice to have a conversation and then like kind of speculate about something, and then now you start to, and three people are looking it up on their phone and telling you what the answer is.
Yeah, it's not as much fun.
No,
but there's still plenty.
Because then you can make it up, and no one would know.
But there's plenty of places you can go that don't have service where you can pretend it's the olden times and
back
do
in,
that.
Yeah,
yeah. But yeah, I agree. It's nice to speculate. But now we can speculate about all new things. We don't have to get caught up in the trivia of whose name it is. You know, we can speculate about a whole other level of things.
Well, and that's nice too, because there are philosophical things that have no answers that you can't actually look up.
Right.
Way more fun to talk about.
Right.
Yeah. Like, I mean, even the horror movies that I saw as a kid, which would be like the Vincent Price ones,
like The Fly and House on Haunted Hill.
Well, the one that got me back in the day was The Fall of the House of Usher.
The Fall of the House of Usher, yeah.
And I remember actually being a young kid in the theater and like not being able to sit in my seat and having to wander out into the lobby and watch it from there.
You couldn't deal.
No, yeah. And I've seen it maybe a couple years ago, and it's still pretty scary because...
Some of those old movies are still scary. I mean, I think Cronenberg's the remake of The Fly notwithstanding. I think the original Fly is still pretty creepy.
Yeah.
And... The Haunting. Have you ever seen the original Haunting?
No, that one I haven't seen.
Super creepy. I mean, to me, that's still one of the only really genuinely good haunted house movies. There's so few.
Yeah, I remember back in the day when I was in school and not really wanted to go to class. I'd go to watch at UCLA. I'd watch sit in a movie class, and they were all in love with Newton, whatever the guy was, the one who did Cat People,
and these
moody atmospheric things that were done in the 40s, and even that they weren't scary. They were kind of atmospheric, but they were...
Yeah, I'm not a... I mean, yeah. Atmosphere is fine, but it only runs so far. Once you get past the first act of your atmosphere, yeah. Something else has got to be going on.
Yeah. And then too, like, we watched the new Wolfman, and I remember thinking the old Wolfman was pretty scary, but this one was just kind of like... It was like a slasher movie now.
The new Wolfman is the Benicio del Toro.
Yes.
Wolfman is a terrible piece of junk. But I do enjoy the gore.
Yeah, and that's...
It takes too long to get there.
Well, and then when it happens, it's almost too fast, too.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. It comes in like really fast bursts of violence that end really suddenly.
Yeah.
But in that way, it was aping when it should have been wolfing. It was aping American Werewolf in London, which is a movie that has, you know, a lot of character development through the whole thing and relationship building and all that. And then suddenly, giant burst of violence, you know? Which I think it was aping, but it still had a modern sensibility where, I mean, when, you know, American Werewolf in London, you spent so much time watching that transformation sequence, which, because it's practical effects too, I think it's still unmatched as far as wolf transformation scenes.
That's like 30-something years ago now, too.
Yeah, yeah. But also you spent so much time with David Naughton just like writhing around naked and sweating and in pain before it even, you know, it happens slightly here and slightly there. So even though the movie has long swaths where it's just like sort of a romantic comedy or whatever, when the stuff happens, it takes its time. Whereas the new Wolfman was kind of trying to do that, but then... The bursts of violence were
well, way and the too bits fast. Of comedy in the old one too were like the what's his name is falling apart throughout the whole. He comes back to talk to him, but he's like his body parts are falling apart.
Oh, Griffin Dunne, yes. Yeah, he's got like flesh hanging off his neck. Yeah, that was hysterical.
It's hysterical. It almost adds to the horror moments that came after that.
But then the original Wolfman, you know, with Lon Chaney, was it Lon Chaney Jr.?
Jr. Yes.
I mean, that, you know, but it's an older movie. I don't know. I mean, it's like, it's probably paced about the same as the new Wolfman, but it's like, it gets to be that way because they had limited resources. And still, the Wolfman is like, what, a 72-minute movie?
I mean, the original one?
Yeah, it's just over an hour.
I think Claude Rains is in it.
Like, when you take that pacing and you stretch it to 2 hours, it's like, what are we doing here, guys? This doesn't make any sense.
I know. I guess it's the times and... I mean, watching that as a kid, I was able to scare the crap out of my brother by just making wolf noises. We were sleeping in the same room, you know, in twin beds. And, like, we watched that movie, and he was scared of it. And I don't know, I'm 4 years older, so it's
Well, it is scary. Everything's scarier when you're little. Yeah, and you haven't seen it before, too. That's the other thing. If you're brought up on a steady diet of modern horror movies, and then you go back and you look at the old ones, and you're not a cinephile, they're not going to resonate with you.
No, like Frankenstein or
unless Dracula. Unless you appreciate cinematic history and like basically have a literary concept of the history of movies, too.
Yeah, because I mean, the three that they used to sell were Frankenstein, Dracula, and Wolfman. Wolfman was the only one that was remotely scary. Dracula wasn't. Really scary. And Frankenstein.
Well, Frankenstein's a sympathetic beast. Yes. I mean, the monster.
Yes.
Dr. Frankenstein's just an asshole. Frankenstein's really a movie about an asshole. And the monster's sympathetic, so he's not as scary.
Yeah. And I think I did read the book once. I think changed from the book because like Tarzan in the book, it's the monster is a intelligent creature who narrates the book, if I remember right.
Oh, yeah? I don't think I've ever read
The Tarzan. Mary Shelley. And Tarzan, you know.
Oh, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. I read that. Yeah.
But Tarzan is, he's educated.
Right, he's very smart.
Yes.
And in the movies, he's a moron.
He's not Johnny Weissmuller. Screaming through the trees.
Wow.
Yeah. I think they filmed a lot of that at the Arboretum, too.
Did they?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, there's that one lake at the Arboretum there that they did a lot of. I think Jungle Jim, too, when Johnny Weissmuller got too big to swing through trees and take off his shirt. He wore a safari outfit and became Jungle Jim.
Yeah, that's good times. I wish I could be a Jungle Jim. Because I can't be a Tarzan. You remember the Christopher Lambert Tarzan?
I do remember that. That was very sad. See, that was, and that's more like the original book.
Yeah, yeah, too. It's true.
Yeah, very sad when his father dies.
It's always sad when people's dads die.
Well, but considering he's an ape.
That's true, but like monkeys dying is super sad, like the chimpanzee movie.
Oh, I didn't see that one, but I heard about
it. It's like Bambi, but it's a documentary. I hated it. It was too sad.
Yeah, there was one they did about meerkats where I think they come back one week and like this meerkat they've been following in this documentary is gone. And it's like, oh yeah, I got eaten. Like that's like the main character of this.
He got eaten. Oh well. Meh. they should do that more in their animated pictures. I would have preferred a lot of the characters in The Lion King had gotten eaten early on.
Yeah, that's. I was reading about that. That I guess they were in production at the same time, Pocahontas and The Lion King, and the one that they thought was going to be huge was Pocahontas, but thought it was The Lion King that maybe it had better music.
I really don't know. I don't like either of those movies. I saw they re-released, because, you know, Disney keeps regurgitating old movies in 3D now.
Yeah. So I bet everybody will be now.
For at least a week or two. Star Wars is doing it. And yeah. But they did Lion King in 3D. So Colby had never seen Lion King, because I don't like Lion King. But then I was like, I'll take him to see Lion King, because he was asking to see it.
It is Hamlet, isn't it?
Yeah, basically, I guess, but without all the intrigue and drama. He didn't like it either.
Really?
I mean, he'll...
Not even the music?
He always says he likes stuff. No, the music, he was climbing the walls. He was climbing the walls. It's just, it's not a very exciting story. It really isn't. I don't get the appeal. Lion King is one of those things you'll never be able to explain to me. Like, you know, even like huge entertainments that I don't necessarily think are great, you know, like, I don't know, Basic Instinct or whatever, I can look at it and go, I get why people dig this, you know, or Glee, you know, I can look at Glee. I don't like Glee.
Yeah.
I don't want to watch Glee, but I can look at Glee and go, I get why people like Glee. I get it, but there are certain things that I just don't get. And The Lion King is in the top five for sure. I don't get why people like it. I don't think the music's very good. It doesn't resonate with me. I'm not a musician, so I only know it in a layman's way. It doesn't resonate with me. The story, I think, is really boring, and the whole movie just seems so derivative of so many other Disney movies.
So when you're in the theater seeing that, everybody around you seems to be enjoying it.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that way. The Four Seasons play, which I can't remember the name of now, there was a play, a musical about the Four Seasons, the group, and everybody in the audience where I saw it was just going crazy for it. Every time a song came on, they were like singing.
Oh, was that
lot.
Like Jersey Boys?
Jersey Boys, yes. Yeah. And I was thinking about it when I was listening to it and watching it. Like I'm alone in the universe here.
Oh my gosh. That's the worst feeling.
Yeah.
It's the worst feeling when you're in a crowd of people who just, the whole crowd gets it. And I don't know if it's that. It's like Titanic. James Cameron's Titanic. I mean, I just don't get it. I get the fascination with the story. I get the fascination with the ship. But I do not get why people like that movie.
Why it became so popular.
Why it's it's considered an American classic. I just don't get it. I mean, the ship sinking notwithstanding.
That's a great sequence, though.
Sure, yeah. I mean, the ship, yeah, the ship sinking is all right, but it takes so long to get there.
Yeah.
And the characters are all so aggravating. And I'm including Kate Winslet. I don't like her in that movie. I like Kate Winslet a lot. I don't like her in the movie. DiCaprio is just, I don't know. He's got no gravitas. Billy Zane is doing doing some kind of weird campy thing. He's still the Phantom or something. Kathy Bates. And the way it's written, I mean, it's not their fault. Well, like, when she's looking at the ship sinking, like, that's the other thing. I mean, even the ship sinking is marred by bad moments. You know, really cheesy moments. The band playing and sliding down the deck together. I mean, I realized that really happened and blah, blah, blah. But it was so, so precious the way it was done. It was so fucking TV movie of the week precious. And then she's out in the lifeboat and she's looking at the ship sinking and says, well, now there's something you don't see every day. And like, all these, like, to me, that was just like, that's so offensive, dudes. Like, if I had been on the boat with her, I would have elbowed her in the face. Do you realize what you're witnessing? I mean, you're witnessing something like that. I don't care how rich you are and how calloused you are. You probably don't say anything.
No.
Until well after the ship is under the water. You know, I just, the whole thing. When I saw it, the Man Chinese, and like, it had been running for a year already, and it was still a sold out thing,
yeah.
The Man Chinese. And I sat there just, I felt so lonely because everybody was so enraptured.
Crying, probably.
Crying throughout, and oh, just.
Yeah.
It just hurts to talk about.
I don't know if it's a Cameron thing, because like, even Avatar for me, I mean, when I saw that, people were going, they were oohing and ahhing through the whole thing, like, okay, it's an animated movie.
Yeah, I mean, Avatar is more, you know, the Emperor's New Clothes for me. I mean, with Cameron at this point, it's just the Emperor's New Clothes. It's like, it's Cameron, it's Avatar, it's the first thing he's done since Titanic, so of course it's going to be awesome. Because you loved Titanic,
yeah. But Terminator. I like the first Terminator.
The first Terminator, I love, and like, I loved Aliens.
Yeah, so like he could do it.
And I have a soft spot for Piranha 2, The Spawning.
He did that.
Yes, that was his first movie. I think they fired him off of it. Actually, it was a horrible experience for him. And then he produced some movies I really like Near Dark and stuff like that.
It's almost like the way I think of, like, with the Harry Potter books, after she'd written two or three of them or four of them, and she, at this point, no one can edit her anymore, and she just would churn out.
That's a huge problem.
No one can edit him anymore. No one can tell him no.
But that's what I don't understand. I mean, it's like, if you're an artist, like, if you're really a good artist, then you're never satisfied with your own work. I mean, you can't be. And you would want not a team of yes men in your life. You would want a team of people who said, I don't know about this. I don't know about this. And like, if you have the final say, you have the final say. If you completely disagree, you completely disagree. But like, so often, like when I'm writing or producing or whatever I'm doing, and I run it by somebody who I know and respect and all that, and they go, oh, I really like this about it, but this is weird, and this is weird, or this is too repetitive, and I look at it, and it's like almost inevitably go, and it's not an insecurity go. When I think about it, I go, oh, that's such a good point. It's so rare that I go, you just don't fucking know. You're not getting this, and that's fine. You don't have to. Somebody else will. It's so rare that I have that reaction. It's usually a reaction of, oh, God, yeah, all I have to do is adjust this, and it'll play better. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know why you'd want nothing but yes men in your life if you're really an artist.
Yeah, and it's like, I think about like directors who directed a lot of good movies, like say Hitchcock or John Ford or people like that, and they used some of the same people over and over again, but it always seemed like they were trying to do something different each time, even if they were within their same comfort zone.
Whether in their wheelhouse, yeah. But Hitchcock, especially. For me, it's interesting to watch, you know, his older, lesser known, like lower budgeted thrillers, you know, like Strangers on a Train and all that stuff. Because all of them, while they're in that genre, like, he's really, with each one, is telling a completely different story and finding new ways to bend the genre. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think I do.
It's like an improv. You know, yes and, you know, do you know that whole thing? The whole rule of improvisation, you know, comedy improvisation is...
The rules for improv?
The rule, yes. That's and that is the rule. I mean, the rule is you don't negate, so you yes and. So if someone comes to you
it's
and
like
says...
It's like a selling rule, too.
Yeah, it says, how you doing, Mr. President? If you say, I'm great. It suddenly changes your performance if you accept it and you stand up straight and you say, I am well. I have many hard decisions to make versus, hey, Mr. President, how you doing? Oh, I'm not the president. I'm a dentist. Then that's no fun. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think great filmmakers, even if they're inside a very specific genre, are constantly yes-anding the genre or yes-anding something. That's the difference between two an homage and ripping something off. Like, so often people are like, well, this is an homage to that. And it's not. You're just doing it again. So that's a ripoff. But if you take a concept or a movie or whatever and you tell a new version of it where you have built upon it and created nuances and made it a richer thing, then you're not ripping it off. You're actually paying an homage. That's yes-anding something.
So are Quentin Tarantino's movies homages or ripoffs?
In the... Instances.
Have another drink. And try that again.
Yeah, let me get another beer. In the instances of that beer is really good, though. Do you want another beer?
Yes.
In the instances of Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, I would say yes. Those are homages. In the more immediate instance of Inglourious Basterds, I would say it's neither a ripoff or an homage. It thinks it's a clever homage, and it does everything wrong that Inglourious Basterds did right. The original that was spelled correctly.
Because it was an Inglourious Basterds movie once. What was that?
That was the cord that I tripped over just then. It happens. Did you like Inglourious Basterds?
I have not seen either. That's why I like to. I like to talk about movies that I haven't seen.
Well, you know, I'd be curious, Ira, knowing you know your taste and what you like. I would be curious about your reaction to that. I mean, and fanboys get so angry when I say I don't like it, but I don't. It's got a great, great opening 20 minutes. The first 20 minutes are so good. And the rest of the movie is directionless hogwash. And it's not an homage to Inglourious Basterds, which is a great... Did you ever see that movie?
I haven't seen the original. I know that there was one.
I mean, it's just The Dirty Dozen. It's The Dirty Dozen. It's Kelly's Heroes, but it's an Italian-produced thing. It's low budget, so it's more, even you know, more exploitative. There's a lot. There's a whole scene with naked, hot Nazi chicks, and the American guys who are on the mission are like, ooh, check them out. And then all of a sudden, the Nazi chicks come out of the water with, like, machine guns shooting at the guys. Like, naked ladies shooting machine guns does not exist in Tarantino's homage. And it's like, of all the things to leave out, why would you leave that out, dude?
Because it would seem to me that, too, that if he's going to make a movie for himself, I mean, he has all this movie knowledge, he has all this movie stuff that he seems to like or revere or whatever, but... Don't you want to make your own movie? Why do you want to make what somebody else did?
Yeah, actually, my friend John always says that to me, but I don't mind that he's like a cinephile who loves making cinephile movies. My problem is that his movies are no longer... I mean, I think it sort of started with Jackie Brown and then it descended. Because Jackie Brown was very hit or miss. It had some good stuff and it had some long, boring stuff. But it didn't have any of the punch of Pulp Fiction or Reservoir Dogs. Or True Romance, which he didn't direct, but True Romance is a fun-ass movie. So my problem now is he regurgitates so much of his own nonsense that it doesn't feel like an homage to another filmmaker from the past or a movie from the past. It feels like he's homaging himself all the time. And in Glorious Bastards, the first scene notwithstanding, there's so much where it seems like, oh, I can show you this exact scene in one of his more effective earlier movies. You know what I mean?
So he's repeating a scene.
He's repeating it, and he's putting it in, and also he's not creating any interesting characters for me to latch on to. And Inglourious Basterds bounces around to so many different people. It's not about the Inglourious Basterds at all. It's about all these other people. And it sort of comes together at the end in this cockamamie way, which, you know, fanboys are like, it's brilliant, I wouldn't have seen it, you know. But I was like, yeah, but, like, I don't want to ruin it for you.
Yeah,
I'm not going to, you know, say, spoiler alert. So, you know, they assassinate Hitler at the end of the movie, and I'm like,
of course they do.
I'm like, you know, this would have been really fun if he'd earned this on any level, but it's just an arbitrary choice that comes at a long string of arbitrary choices that add up to a bunch of sometimes okay scenes, sometimes less than okay scenes, but don't add up to a narrative at all. I mean, so it's just...
It's not an alternate history.
No. It's like you see the trailers for Inglourious Basterds and you got Brad Pitt talking in a funny accent, which I was on board for. I was down for saying, you know, I want Nazi scalps. We're scalping Nazis. And I'm like, I'm on board. I'll watch a whole goddamn 2.5-hour movie about scalping Nazis.
Yeah.
I'm on board. There's precious little scalping of Nazis in that movie. Precious little. And way too much Eli Roth. Dude can't act.
That's the director of small budget horror movies.
Hostel and Hostel Part 2. And I stand by Hostel Part 2 as a marvelous exercise in awfulness. Not like awful filmmaking, but just like inappropriateness. Yes. It's disgusting and wrong, and it knew it. And I enjoyed the hell out of that. So my hat's off to Eli for that. But he's a terrible, terrible actor that Tarantino keeps putting in his movies and bothers me.
You know, I was wondering about that too. Like there are some people that seem to get the, like their well, what's his name, the Batman guy, director now, seems to have the same people in his movies.
Nolan, yeah.
Nolan, and it seems that sometimes you latch onto a great group of people that make your movies better, and then sometimes you have these people and you're wondering why they're using the same friends, Like, I guess Adam Sandler, doesn't he have, like, some of his same people in his movies?
The more interesting thing about Adam Sandler is, like, who he chooses to make his Happy Madison non-Adam Sandler movies, where, like, maybe he'll have a cameo or whatever, but they're, like, smaller budgeted movies, like Bucky Larson, Born to be a Star, and Deuce Bigelow, and all that stuff, where his, like, he puts his buddies in the lead, and I'm just like, wow, those are... That's something else.
Power. But those movies make money then, too, because I have a feeling the budget's awfully low.
I don't know. I mean, I think eventually they do. You know, like Grandma's Boy or whatever it was called. And that movie bombed in the theater, but it became a cult hit on video. I think, like, he gets a lot of return on video for those kind of junky movies. Because they're born to be cable perennials, you know. So now, they're just, you put them on cable, it's awesome.
Yeah, what was that, the movie that we watched the other day, Blood Beach? Like, there's a movie, like, I'm thinking, that movie got made. I remember saying
that movie got made and greenlit because of its tagline. I guarantee you.
And then it had relatively well-known actors from the time, John Saxon, the guy from Rocky movies.
Yeah, Paulie. What's his name? Burt Young,
yeah. And then the movie that you were in, it's like, okay, that is a better made movie, and it got made too, but it's not like it's distributed, I guess.
Well, not yet. I mean, Fuzz Track City is, which is the movie you're talking about, right?
Yes.
You're not talking about Devil in the Flesh 2.
Oh, you made Devil in the Flesh 2?
I was in Devil in the Flesh 2. Huh. It was.
Were you in the flesh or the devil? No,
I was not sexualized on any level. I was the comic relief, sadly, in Devil in the Flesh 2. No, it was Jodie Lynn O'Keefe, who is the hot femme fatale in that movie. And that guy from Nightmare on Elm Street. Not
Robert Englund.
Not Robert Englund. Not Johnny Depp. It's so funny. I see him every now and then, and this guy... I think his last name's Garcia. I can't believe I'm blanking on his name. Nicest guy. Anyway, Zhu, maybe his name is Zhu Garcia or something like that. I think he's actually changed his name more than once. Anyway.
That's a good idea to do.
He's a really nice guy. Like, super good looking guy. And I see him all the time on the freeway. Like, every now and then. Couple of years. This movie's, like, 12 years old now, 13 years old now. And every now and then I'll see this guy on the 101. And he'll be like, wave at me. And I'll be like, oh, hey, what's up, dude? And that's it. That's our entire relationship. Devil in the Flesh. What was I talking about? Oh, yeah, Fuzz Track City. So Fuzz Track City is currently, going around to festivals.
Right.
So it could conceivably get, some decent distribution. And it's doing pretty well. So we'll see. It's gotten a lot of, honors at various festivals. And in fact, it was at the Phenom Fest. I think they call it Phenom, or maybe it's Phenom. I don't know. If it's pretentious, it's Phenom. But it doesn't seem like a pretentious festival at all. So.
Is it with an F or a PH?
PH, like phenomenal. Yes. Or yeah. Phenomenon. So Phenom Fest, I assume it's pronounced. But it's Louisiana-based. And they give it a couple of awards, I think. Cinematography and editing and best actor, as it turns out.
So
I was very excited about that. But in other festivals, it's gotten best supporting actor and best director and all that stuff. So, and it's got, there's three more festivals it's set at now, and we haven't heard about East Coast stuff yet. So hopefully it'll be on the East Coast too, but it'll be in Grand Rapids in a few weeks, and it's going to be back in Hollywood in November at the Arclight for the Hollywood Film Festival.
And just out of curiosity, what I know a lot of it was filmed years ago and some of it was filmed recently, I guess. But what is that? If they have to put a date on it, is it 2012 as far as...
When it's released, yeah. I think it'll be... Yes, I think it's 2012 because it premiered at Dances with Films. But... on IMDb, that year changed, because Steve Hicks, the, guy who did everything. I mean, it's like he did everything. He wanted it to be done earlier, but because it's a lot of it was because it's a music-driven piece. So they had to find, they couldn't afford the rights to the songs that he dreamed about having in it. But so, they had to find... songs that equated that feeling, and he had to write the title track to it and all that stuff. So it took, the post, which just took a long time.
Because then I hear about some movies that, like, there was a movie there with the guy who was I can't remember names anymore. I think that's a definite sign.
I was never good with names, so...
old age. But one of those movies that sat around for a couple of years, and then they release it, and they promote the hell out of it, and then you think, okay, that movie wasn't that great, and then you realize it sat around for 2 years before they released it.
That happens all the time. But that's different. That's different. I mean, that's... Fuzz Track City is clearly a labor of love, and it's an indie movie, and it's not... that it sat on, it's not that it was sitting on the shelf. It was years of post-production. And that's a completely different ball of wax than when somebody has a finished product and for whatever reason they go, fuck this. Let's put it on the shelf and we'll call it a tax write-off until suddenly we think it can make some money.
Like somebody in it makes another movie.
Which, and you don't know which end is up. I mean, like, Joseph Gordon-Levitt was in Batman, and then suddenly Premium Rush is coming out. I'm like, really, a bike messenger movie? This seems like such a straight-to-video affair to me.
Yeah, and probably it only came out.
And I was amused by its junkiness. It's junk, but it was amusing enough for me. But I was like, this has got to be because he was in... Batman. And then he's got Looper coming out. Maybe that has something to do with it too. But
yeah. Well, and I think that's the same guy that directed Brick that he was in way back when, did Looper.
Oh, right. So I just, you know, but I don't know that Premium rushed out on the shelf, or it's like they just rushed something into production because they're like, Batman's going to do well. We throw this guy in Batman to something we can make money off of.
Yeah.
Or if it was something that sat on the shelf for 4 years and then they're like, holy crap, let's dust this off because Joseph Gordon-Levitt's doing all right.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Did Inception.
But yeah, I think that happens all the time. Actually, one of my favorite examples of that is a Texas Chainsaw Massacre sequel, to bring it full circle. Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Next Generation.
Oh, really?
That was The Next Generation. Was made in the 90s, and it sat on the shelf for several years. And then it got a very limited theatrical release because the Texas Chainsaw junkies were screaming for it. And, you know, it bombed, and they put it on video. And it's got Viggo Mortensen.
Oh, really?
It's got Renee Zellweger. And it's got, in the lead, like the head family crazy guy is Matthew McConaughey. And I'm pretty sure there are a couple other famous people in there that I can't remember.
He'd make a good crazy guy, too.
He's a very amusing in this movie. Yeah. I mean, I would say there's a huge amusement factor on the side of the family. Renee Zellweger, like as a scream queen, not a good idea.
Yeah,
not a good idea.
I can see that.
Bad call, guys. But they're amusing. But the movie's such a train wreck of a mess. You know, you can see why they were like, oh, Jesus Christ, what are we going to do?
Even with all those people at it, even with...
It was like, well, you know, they weren't famous at the time, but that's why I wound up getting a theatrical release years later, is because Zellweger was suddenly, like, nominated for an Oscar, and Matthew McConaughey became a big star, and Viggo was on the rise. Mm-hmm. So they're like, let's put that out, and...
Mm-hmm. I wonder if he'll get an appearance in the Hobbit book, the Hobbit movies that are coming out, Viggo. I wonder if he...
I don't know.
I was trying to think, if you actually go by the books, he's not born yet.
What was his name in the movie? Algernon or Algorithm?
Aragorn.
Algorithm?
Thank you. Yeah, he's Aragorn, otherwise known as Strider.
Algernon, yeah. He started, like, he was retarded, and they gave him smart pills, and then he fought well, and then he got retarded again because the pills stopped working?
Yes, that was Charlie.
I don't know what you're talking about. That was Lord of the Rings.
That was actually a better short story, Flowers for Algernon, than a novel. And because the short story is way compact.
Right, and then he turned it into a novel, and then they turned it into a movie.
They turned it into a movie.
I like the movie.
They changed the movie to Charlie.
Charlie, yeah.
The name of the guy.
Well, you know, I don't know if you watched my last episode of the Film Pigs, but we did a trailer called, it was Flowers for Algernon, reimagined by Steven Spielberg, maker of War Horse, and it's about a retarded horse who... takes smart pills, and then he is a smart horse, but then he gets retarded again, and it's called
Flowers for... No, it's...
Charlie Horse.
Charlie Horse, of course.
Of course. Yeah, there it is. So, yeah.
Horse, of course.
Yeah. I don't know about you, but I've got so many more interviews to get to. So.
Probably should get going, because I think I have to pick up a child somewhere.
Oh, well,
maybe on Santa Monica
child
Boulevard.
Or just any just child?
Got to head down to Santa Monica.
You
got to
get some children? Yes. That's really weird and creepy. I'm going to call the police once you leave.
Thank you. So that's the end then, huh?
Yeah, that's the end.
Good.
Are you signing off? Was that your sign off?
I think that's my sign off. That's the end then.
That's the end then.